The next case is 02-1750 United States versus Roger Dean and 02-1850 United States.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please the court, I am William Christie, counsel for appellant Roger Bodwin. This is an appeal of the district court's order denying Mr. Bodwin and Mr. Champagne's motion to suppress, in which the district court found that an anonymous 911 call lacking in probable cause nevertheless provided reasonable grounds for the Hooksett police to conduct a warrantless search of a hotel room and its occupants pursuant to an emergency exception to the Fourth Amendment. And our argument here is split today between myself and Mr. Gordon, who represents Mr. Champagne, and I intend to focus, to the extent plausible, my discussion on the exigent circumstances arguments in our briefs. The district court should be reversed because, in its opinion, it acknowledged that probable cause was not present in this case when the police approached the door and when they entered the hotel room. Now, under the prior guidance from this circuit and the clear precedent from other circuits, when the police are faced with an emergency situation, an exigent circumstances probable cause test is applied. And in this case here, the police received an anonymous 911 call that was lacking in probable cause. And the police, upon receipt of that call, did nothing to corroborate the call prior to effectuating the entry.
Counsel, are you arguing against the appropriateness of an emergency doctrine generally, or are you arguing against its applicability to the facts in this case?
I think we need to recognize that when the police, we're not arguing against an emergency doctrine in theory. I think what our position is that the emergency doctrine should be reviewed under the straightforward exigent circumstances test, which has a probable cause component to it, rather than the test adopted by the district court, which has a lower standard, a reasonable grounds standard.
Suppose the anonymous call in this case referred to the fact that same content, except somebody has just been shot in that room, and it's a result of a drug deal gone bad, instead of a reference to somebody being dead in the room. How would you view that under an exigent circumstances standard?
Well, I believe if the report was that someone had been shot, the call would have greater reliability or greater exigent circumstances, certainly, than the call that was actually reported. However, I still believe that the police would be required to corroborate the reliability of that call. And the reasons for that, if you look at the case law, one of the issues relied upon by the other circuits that have looked at this issue is whether the call is anonymous or not. And other circuits have said that when the caller identifies himself or herself and identifies the basis of their knowledge, there's more reliability to the call. And in this case, certainly, and in the example that Your Honor just presented, even in those examples, the 911 calls would not have that level of reliability.
Counsel, I do share some of your concerns about the emergency doctrine. Here, it's clear your clients were set up, right? Somebody calls with a false report about what's going on in a motel room. One doesn't know why they made that call. But they made a call and they made a false report that someone had been murdered. Well, that there was a dead body.
Correct.
Drug deal gone bad, the implication is someone's been murdered. Now, I suppose there's a possibility of an overdose. All right. And so it's easy for people to make anonymous calls that say there's an emergency, someone's dead, someone's dying, and the rest. But as I look at this case, what the police did in response to the call was attempt to corroborate it. They went to the motel. And I tend to think that the inevitable discovery doctrine would have worked here once, is it Mr. Bowden who's asked to step out and then he's asked if he has a weapon?
That is correct, Ron.
Okay. And he says, yes, he has a weapon, so they pat him down, which they're certainly justified in doing to protect themselves. And they find weapon and drugs. At that point, there's probable cause to go into the room. And at that point, whatever happened in the room is justified by the inevitable discovery doctrine. So what's wrong with the police asking him to step out of the doorway in light of an anonymous call that says there are two crimes, drug dealing and murder? They don't probably expect to find anyone in the room. To their surprise, they find someone in the room who, at a minimum, given the information that there may have been a murder, they have a right to protect themselves by patting down the defendants. And you can't pat him down in the doorway, so you ask him to step outside. What's wrong with that in Fourth Amendment terms?
If the police, and that raises a factual issue at the underlying suppression hearing, which Judge Barbadaro
No, actually, could not resolve, it doesn't. Frankly, I don't care if he consented to step out of the room. The real question is, were they justified in light of those facts in asking him to step out of the doorway?
I believe to the contrary, that based upon the information that was available to them, they could not forcibly...
But they didn't forcibly. They asked him to step out of the room. They didn't physically seize him.
I have the red light.
Go ahead and answer the question.
If Mr. Baldwin stepped outside consensually, I think we'd have to concede that your observation is correct. However, I don't believe the evidence supports that. If Mr. Baldwin stepped out to a direct command by the police, that based upon the information that was available to them, they certainly did not have probable cause or even reasonable suspicion to search the room, to do a non-consensual search of the room.
No, but remember, the search of the room isn't the issue, because I think we may have agreed that it's reasonable to think that once they pat him down and they find the weapons and they find the drugs, that then they have probable cause to go into the room and inevitable discovery would have led to the search of the room in any event.
I agree, but I believe once he steps out to their command, that is essentially a seizure. And if you want to characterize it as
why? Why is that a seizure?
Because he has the ability at that point in time when the police come to the door to not answer their questions, to not step outside. Mm-hmm. So if he steps outside based upon their direct command, then in that scenario, if he has been instructed to step outside by the police and he complies, mm-hmm. then at that point in time, he has been seized by the police.
Now, in a Terry stop situation, is an officer justified in asking someone to step outside of the car?
Well, I...
So he can be patted down?
I step outside of a car if the officer has reason to believe the fear for his safety or her safety, I think that's correct.
Well, if there's an anonymous call that there's a drug deal gone bad and that there's a dead body in the room, don't you think that gives a reasonable officer some room to be worried about the guy he just unexpectedly found in the room?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that under the federal case law, certainly there's a significant difference regarding the expectation of privacy between an automobile and a hotel or a dwelling house. And so I do believe the analysis is different there. If this was a situation at an automobile, I think we would have to concede your point. At a hotel room, I believe the police needs, in order to direct him to step out, they need something more than reasonable suspicion. I believe they need probable cause.
Is there anything in the record about whether there's a back door from the motel room?
I don't believe that there is, Your Honor.
In the record, okay.
In the record.
Counsel, Judge Papagoro, he chose not to make a finding with respect to what was a dispute. Is that correct? Wasn't there a dispute as to whether Mr. Bowden was ordered to step out or whether he stepped out consensually and agreed to be patted down? Is that, Judge Papagoro does not resolve that factual dispute. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the government invited him to resolve that dispute and to rule in the alternative as a Terry-type situation, and he declined to do so. And interestingly, if he had agreed to do so,
Your client did not testify at the suppression hearing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Your client did not testify at the suppression hearing?
He did not.
To give his version of the events?
That is correct.
And I believe the two officers who were there both say that Mr. Bowden was requested to step out of the room, and the only difference in their testimony is one said that the circumstances were explained before he was asked to step out of the room, and the other says the circumstances were explained after he was asked to step out of the room.
I believe there's also, that is correct, Your Honor. I believe there's also another factual distinction. Sergeant Chamberlain, who was the senior officer at the scene, testified that he ordered Mr. Bowden to step out. And that was and that's at page 196 of the addendum. That was in response to a direct question by Judge Barbadoro. Judge Barbadoro asked him, did you ask him to come out or did you order him to come out? And to Sergeant Chamberlain's credit, he said, I ordered him to come out.
Okay. And is it your position that every time an officer does that, that is then automatically a seizure, regardless of other circumstances?
Is it dispositive on
the question of whether there's a seizure?
I'm not prepared to say regardless of other circumstances. I am prepared to say based upon the facts of this case and the fact that they were at a room that's, for Fourth Amendment purposes, is considered a dwelling, it's certainly a seizure.
You know, it's a funny question. We have said motel rooms are like homes, and certainly in homes, the Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy is at its highest. But I was trying to think about this question. Why do you think motel rooms have exactly the same degree of protection as homes?
Well, I believe it's because it is a place of where people go. They expect privacy. It's a place.
Suppose the manager of the hotel room had knocked on the door and asked him to step outside.
I think that would be a different scenario. And in fact,
But does it go to the expectation of privacy?
I think it does go to the expectation of privacy. But I think by the same nature, if you live at home and the police come and your spouse is in the yard, your spouse could come to the door and let the police in, just as the hotel manager could
do.
In the hotel setting.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I'm Joshua Gordon. I represent the defendant, Robert Champagne. I don't think this case is about some intricate doctrinal construction. I think it springs direct from the Fourth Amendment. The government urges a new emergency exception, and it's no secret that the Fourth Amendment has plenty of exceptions, but the exception urged by the government here brings the Fourth Amendment full circle, and I think I can explain this. The police have next to no information. All they know is that there's a drug deal gone bad and a 911 call of a possible dead body. So the hooks that police go to the place, and that's the reasonable thing to do, and they knock on the door, and naturally the guy inside answers the door. And the police order the guy out, and I think that's well established in the record. And that's the next logical step, because the cop wants to get in. In issuing the order, the police here use their first Fourth Amendment exception, what the government is requesting I'll call the anonymously alleged crime scene exception. Then, without any probable cause or articulable suspicion, the police search the guy, because naturally they're worried for the safety. And this is exception number two. This is the Terry exception. So then the door is open, and the police can see inside, and that's exception number three, because now there's the plain view exception. The police see the roommate, my client, and by the way, he's living in this hotel room. This is not a temporary stay for him.
Does that make any difference?
I don't think so. I think there's a hotel is a home, and they're the same for Fourth Amendment purposes. But the police see my client stride to the bureau, either to collect his valuables, a reasonable thing when someone shows up at your door at 5 a.m., or to reach for a weapon, which, although there's no evidence of a gun here, might also be a reasonable thing to do when someone calls at an odd hour, and some people exercise the Second Amendment rights just for that purpose. But in any case, the police consider it a furtive movement, and they go in. So that's exception number four. And the police get into a man's home on a series of exceptions. They still haven't gotten around to looking for a dead body, which is their purported purpose.
Did they step into the room before or after they found the stuff on the other man?
Before.
Okay.
So using the Terry exception for the second time, they search my client and find contraband on him. So if we let the first exception go by, the anonymously alleged crime scene exception, then we have a situation that all the police need to do to get into a man's home is the observation of the most ordinary thing, a knock on the door, and the answer when there's a knock on the door, open the door when you see it's a cop, collect your things when the knock comes at an odd hour. But what the language of the Fourth Amendment says is the right to be secure in your things against unreasonable searches and seizures, but upon probable cause. So this isn't a doctrinal difficulty. This is right from the Fourth Amendment. There's no probable cause here, and the police are in a man's home. The police have successfully worked through this set of five exceptions to accomplish precisely what the Fourth Amendment says they can't do. And it's not based on, unordinary facts like three men casing a jewelry store in Terry or the corroboration of a phone call in Mincy. This is ordinary facts. And the exception urged by the government here takes these old exceptions, brings it full circle.
But to go back to the language of the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable searches and seizures, what was unreasonable about what the police did here, going through your sequence of events?
Well, nothing. That's the problem. But we have the Fourth Amendment says you can't do that without probable cause. You get into a man's home without probable cause. The police didn't do anything unreasonable, except I suppose they didn't do anything to corroborate the 911 call. They had this.
How would you do that other than go to the place?
Well, you go to the place, and when you notice, depending upon what stage in the events are, you see that, the little penknife that Mr. Bowden had, didn't have blood on it. You look inside the apartment, there's no evidence of a crime or blood, or no one's up around the place. There's no
commotion. Excuse me, there are two crimes, drugs and murder, right?
Right, but they're there to go find the dead body, they claim.
Well, yes, but then they find drugs when they pat down Mr. Bowden. So the fact that they haven't found a body doesn't get you off the hook that another crime may be involved.
If they're there to investigate a crime, I think all bets are off here. And I think Judge Barbadaro didn't, he found that the primary purpose here was to look for harmed dead people, or people in need of aid. But they went into the room before they patted down Mr. Bowden.
Counsel, are you saying that this emergency exception, that in itself eviscerates the Fourth Amendment? Is that your argument? Or are you saying that if one piles on exception on top of exception on top of a section on top of exception, that kind of analysis of this rate's a Fourth Amendment. It sounds to me like the analysis that you just went through is apart from the emergency justification, which Judge Barbadoro ultimately focused on. I mean, he seems to share your uneasiness with the analysis that you just described, and so he avoids it and approaches it somewhat differently under this emergency doctrine. What is it you are saying?
Well, I think the emergency doctrine is inherent in this sort of situation. If the police can go to a place and sort of wiggle their way inside by a variety of exceptions based on very ordinary events, I think whether this exception is standing alone or in tandem with others, I'm not sure it matters. The exception has gone too far.
It's the combination of the two. It's the combination of the emergency exception with the other exceptions. So if I understood your answer, it's not either or, it's and.
Perhaps that's right, but I think it's a common occurrence. This is how it would always work or often work. Anonymous call, police go to the door.
Interesting.
If you use
the emergency exception here, it inevitably leads to a chain of other exceptions, which inevitably leads to undermining the Fourth Amendment.
Is that
your argument?
That's right. And I have one more thing to say about this. Certainly we've all encountered an unhappy lover or uncompensated business associate or officious neighbors. As lawyers and judges, we have we know people who blame us for their troubles or have gone to jail. And if all they have to do is drop a dime and anonymously allege there's a murder in your home, thereby causing the police to intrude upon your privacy, and that's gone too far.
Would they have a right to knock on the door and go in looking for a body, or do they have to say, you have a body here? And obviously they'd say no. Then what do they do?
Well, I think their obligation is to corroborate with the normal tools the police have. What else do they observe about the people, the surroundings, and that's the corroboration is the way you distinguish the dud, like this case, there is no dead body, from a case where there really is something wrong. There, more than likely, I suspect, I trust the cops and their powers of observation. If they go to a place and something happened like this, well, then I think there would be something to corroborate the call.
I'd have to go in the shower or the bathroom or something like that, or look under the bed, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, I think so, but, are there people up? Is there noise? Is there, what other facts can the police develop? And they're good at developing them to suggest that there actually was a murder. May I address sentencing for a moment? I didn't get to that argument.
Take 2 minutes.
As to the steel saw being used as a weapon, I suggest you go to your Home Depot or your local hardware store and try to pick up a steel saw on display there and imagine how a 117-pound, emaciated, drug-addicted 54-year-old with breathing problems and back problems that cause him to be chair-bound often.
I understand your argument, but the district court said two things. One, the safety was taped over, so it was a more dangerous saw.
Yeah.
And two, what was it doing there if it wasn't meant to intimidate other people? Whether it actually gets used as a weapon or not, it's useful because it's a potential weapon to intimidate people. So that's what you have to respond to.
Well, the standard is clearly improbable that it could be used as a weapon. My client can't use this thing as a weapon. It's heavy. He can't. I think it's clearly improbable, and that's why I suggest you go pick one up.
Pretty odd circumstance to find something like this in a motel room.
It's not on the record. My client claims he was fixing his car. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the Court, Terry Olala on behalf of the United States from the District of New Hampshire. I believe, Your Honors, that the courts in Mitchell and Wayne got this right, that this is an emergency exception case. of the United States at the suppression hearing had advanced a Terry-type stop. I think Judge Barbadoro was reluctant to rule on the Terry-type stop because there was conflicting testimony as to whether or not Mr. Bodwin was ordered out or asked to come out. Nevertheless, even if Your Honors find that he was ordered out, the Second Circuit in Gorey has indicated that when police officers are conducting a Terry-type stop, you can order an individual out of a protected home. If that were to happen, and it did happen in these cases, a pat frisk of Mr. Bodwin found drugs. That established probable cause. The probable cause would have inevitably discovered or resulted right. in Mr. Champagne.
Judge Diane Wood's decision for the Seventh Circuit, I've forgotten which one it was. Basically, simply viewed the emergency doctrine not as a freestanding doctrine, but simply as another aspect of exigent circumstances. And she combined the sort of usual exigent circumstances test with a little added potential emergency here. Is that a theory that the government is presenting to us?
I think, Your Honor, I think under any... under a Terry case, we win. Under the emergency exception doctrine, no matter how you view the subjective intent, objective intent, I still think we win. I think the facts in Richardson, if that's what Your Honor is referring to, the Seventh Circuit case, 2000 case, those facts were much worse than the facts here. In that case, there had been a week earlier another false 911 call to the same resident. And here, we didn't have those facts. This was a case with a 911 call, drug deal gone bad, potential person who's dead. They do attempt to corroborate. They go to the hotel, see the only lights on at a cheap hotel, and approach the door. They see movement inside. Mr. Bowen looks out the window. He sees that there are uniformed policemen there, and what does he do? He opens the door only to display his face. That's corroboration. When he's requested to step outside, he's asked, do you have a weapon? Yes, I have a weapon. That's absolute corroboration that there may be someone dead inside. A pat frisk reveals drugs.
I'm sorry. He only displayed his face.
Correct.
What's the significance of that? That he didn't want people to look into the room? Is that what it is?
No, that he may have something to hide. If a police officer, if I look out a window of a motel room that I'm staying at and I see a uniformed police officer, there's no reason I wouldn't open my door wide. When you open a door only a couple of inches and display your face, the government's argument is you have something to hide. When you step outside...
You may be wearing a bathrobe.
That's correct. But at the time, Your Honor, when there's movement inside, that's what the testimony was. As soon as the door was open, as soon as Mr. Bodwin stepped out, they saw Mr. Champagne hurry across the room to a bureau.
What's the significance of it being a cheap motel?
It's much more likely that drugs could have been being dealt there and that a homicide could have occurred. I think it all goes into the totality of the circumstances and the attempt by law enforcement to corroborate these innocent facts or the tip. But I think that law enforcement don't necessarily have to corroborate in a case like this with an emergency exception because in most instances you wouldn't be able to corroborate. What happens if it's a call?
Aren't most police departments now using caller ID? Isn't this a transitional problem?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I would assume that law enforcement officers would be able to attempt to corroborate through a caller ID. But again, if you have a report of someone dying, would law enforcement officers step back?
But that was not the report here.
Okay. Someone is potentially dead. I think there's a dead body there. The same applies. Should law enforcement take a step back and say, let's take a look at who this caller is. Let's check. Let's wait till the morning so we can do a subpoena to the phone company. You can't do that.
No. But you can call them right back and say, give me more information.
And what happens, Your Honor, especially if the caller says, I'm not going to give you more information, hang up. Do you then find...
Then the police have attempted to cooperate, and then they go to the next step.
Exactly. And the next step is they attempted to corroborate just like they did here, and they went to the hotel. If this were a case where there was a call where an individual was living in a home and there was a report of a bomb that he had and there was a parade going by his house, the police go to the residence. What do they do? How do they corroborate? Yeah.
The difficulty is it is so very easy to make anonymous calls, and it's so very easy to set up a situation where the privacy of someone's home is invaded. Here the call was false.
True. And I'm not saying that there won't be many more false calls, but I think that the Constitution can't be viewed in a vacuum, and because police officers have the responsibility to care for society, that's got to give way when there are reports of individuals who may be injured and who may be there dying.
Counsel, in Florida versus JL, the Supreme Court very recently, in a unanimous decision, expressed considerable concerns about police responding to an anonymous call in a situation where a young man was, the report was the young man had a gun.
Sure.
And they went to the scene and found some corroboration. There had been a reference to a red plaid shirt. They saw somebody with a red plaid shirt. Acted on that basis, did a pat down, found a gun. The Supreme Court said that doesn't fly under the Fourth Amendment.
And it shouldn't fly under the Fourth Amendment, because in our society today we have many individuals carrying guns. That in and of itself isn't bad.
It isn't even an indicia of a crime.
And it's not.
Depending on his age and whether he had a license, it might have been perfectly legal for him to be carrying the firearm.
Exactly. But the Supreme Court did specifically say in JL that they are not passing on the fact that there may well be instances, and I think that they cited, for example, a call involving a bomb, where there could be an intrusion into a protected area in order to protect society. That's what we have here.
But there you can protect. A dead body is dead. And one understands that maybe the person is not dead and maybe you need to get them there. But it really is different than the imminent harm to a bunch of people situation.
Well, I think the caller here said there may be a dead body in there. I think the cases have indicated, and the testimony of law enforcement have indicated, we're not the experts. If someone says there's a dead body, does that mean that we don't respond? What happens if they didn't respond?
The difficulty is, if you set up a rule, and the defense argues this in their brief, that there is a dead body exception to the Fourth Amendment, then you set up the real potential for mischief.
Well, I think Mincy made that clear, that the homicide exception won't fly when you have 4 days of uninterrupted searches. I think what you need is, if there's a potential for a dead body, you go to the scene, you secure the area, you see if there's a dead body, you do pat frisk. And if you see nothing else, you leave. The government's position has got to be that way. Otherwise, people will die. People will continue to die who may be assisted through law enforcement.
Under your position, then the officers had a right to go immediately into the room without asking questions. Mm-hmm. They just...
Yeah. I think that...
Proceed.
No, I think that depending upon the circumstances, but the circumstances here, I think they acted appropriately to knock on the door, to ask the individuals to step out, to do a pat frisk. Once they did the pat frisk, that's when the trouble started, because it was further corroboration of what the tip was.
But they went on in the room before they finished the pat down of Mr. What's his name, Bowden?
That's true, but the only reason they went into the room is that Mr. Champagne, they saw him inside, hurry across the room, and had his back to them and was fiddling with something on a dresser and putting something in his hands. They believed he might have a weapon. They went in to only stop him and secure him from grabbing a weapon. Yes. In other circumstances, I think they could have done that on a tip. Do I think police officers can just barge into a house with a tip of a drug deal gone bad, potential body, without knocking? No, I think that's a bit much. But again, it all depends on the facts.
Without knocking?
Well,
that's not the issue here. I mean, you seem to say, well, they could knock, they could wait a reasonable time, and they could go straight in. based on that information alone.
I believe that was what Judge Slaughter was trying to get at.
Based on these facts, I believe they could, Your Honor.
I'm going to say, everything follows from, it sounds like everything follows from their order to Mr. Bowden to step out. There's an acknowledgement by the officer, one of the officers, that he ordered him to step out. He orders him to step out. He opens the door wide to do so, I gather. That exposes the room. It exposes the actions of the co-defendant moving towards the bureau. So it seems that everything hinges on the legal basis for that initial instruction to him to step out so that he can be patted down. Now, Judge Barbadaro seems to be very uneasy with the legal basis for that initial order. Everything seems to hinge, put aside the emergency doctrine for a moment, everything seems to hinge on the legal basis for that initial directive to Mr. Bowden to step out into the hallway. What was the legal basis for that?
But I think Judge Barr was uneasy on a Terry-type stop to find it was a pure Terry-type stop. I don't think he was uneasy in finding that they had every right to go in and to look for a dead body. Now, I don't know whether I've answered your question.
No, you haven't. It is a key question in the case. Let's assume that the instruction, whether politely put or not, amounts to an order.
Mm-hmm.
Under these circumstances, do you think there was a seizure? Or alternatively, under these circumstances, do you think there wasn't? Or that in any event, it's justified in Fourth Amendment terms?
If there was a seizure, if there was an order come out of the room, that is a seizure. If it was a request, that is not a seizure. If he didn't come out, I do believe the officers still had the ability to go in to check for a dead body.
On what basis?
On the emergency exception doctrine.
All right. If it were a seizure, if it were an order to come out, are you saying it is nonetheless justified under the Fourth Amendment? And if so, why?
Under Terry, yes, because under Terry, as articulated in Gorey, you can order someone to come out in a protected area in order to question them.
So you're saying if it were a seizure, it was at most a temporary seizure in order to enable a pat-down?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there was at that point a reasonable suspicion of what?
That there could have been a dead body inside, and that the officers wanted to look for the dead body, but before doing so, they needed to ensure their own safety and to pat frisk Mr. Bowden to make sure he didn't have any weapons.
And the reasonable suspicion of the dead body is based entirely on that anonymous phone call. Is
yes,
that your position?
And the corroboration, albeit small, of that call.
And the corroboration is finding that one room still lit at 5 o'clock in the morning?
Yes. One room still lit, approaching the door, seeing Mr. Bowden open up the curtain, seeing a shadow move across the room, having Mr. Bowden open the door and only reveal his face. That's the corroboration. And that's the only corroboration.
Is it enough? Well, it's interesting. You view it as corroboration that a crime has been committed. I suppose the alternative is that all of those circumstances heighten the risk to the officers.
Of course.
And they do the minimal amount necessary to enable them to continue to investigate.
Of course, to conduct the Terry-type pat frisk.
Okay.
If Your Honors do not have any other questions, I thank you, and I'll be seated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.